All rise for the Honorable Judge Michael Mikey McGillicuddy.
I am calling this session to order. Madam Foreperson, have you reached a verdict?
You're goddamn right we have. I mean, yes, Your Honor.
What find you with regard to the first charge? Namely, that Quantitude intentionally and with malice both failed to appreciate and willfully chose not to discuss a thoughtful and insightful contribution to the Future of Teaching episode made by the plaintiff, Dr. Daniel McNeish, also known to the court as Knuckles.
Oh, wicked guilty, Your Honor.
And what find you with regard to the second charge? Namely, that Quantitude, in subsequent social media posts, both implicitly and explicitly contributed to mocking the plaintiff's Boston upbringing and his alleged inability to say words starting with or substantially containing the letter R.
Guilty as fuck, Your Honor. I'm just saying.
And what say you with regard to the third and final charge? Namely, that Quantitude is an embarrassment to the podcast community and at best should have stopped after, like, the fifth episode.
I know, right? It's a freaking travesty, Your Honor. Guilty. Ha! Looks like they got a guilty hat trick. Go Bees!
I thank the jury for your service. You are hereby excused.
Hey, Danny, call me. Call me.
Will the defendants please rise? It is the wisdom of the impartial jury. Thanks again, Mary Elizabeth. That was great.
You're totally welcome, Your Honor.
That you have been found guilty on all three counts. Forthwith, in contrition for your willful ignoring Dr. McNeish's submitted audio comments on teaching, you shall dedicate an entire episode of your so-called podcast in the careful weighing and discussion of his pearls of wisdom and crafting of the spoken word. Forthwith, in contrition for your willful mocking of his inability to use the letter R in any reasonable setting, in light of his God-given Boston upbringing, you shall dedicate an entire second episode of your podcast to personally interviewing him about any of what I'm sure are brilliant papers. May the Lord have mercy on you two, poor excuses for academics. This court is adjourned.
Oh, dude, I have such an amazing idea for an episode this week.
Oh my gosh, Patrick, what's that idea?
What I was thinking is, do you remember when Dan McNeish submitted that incredibly insightful comment in our teaching episode?
Blew me away.
If you also remember that it was so insightful and inspiring, we did not have time to fully address it in the glory that it deserved.
Yes, although we had every intention of doing so.
What I would suggest is we remind the listeners about what Dr. McNeish said that really kind of changed our lives, if we think about it.
In all likelihood, they've committed most of it to memory, but it wouldn't hurt just to refresh.
It wouldn't hurt. So here is Dr. McNeish.
Hi, I'm Dan McNeish, and I'm an associate professor in quantitative psychology at Arizona State University. When asked about teaching, the expanded interest in teaching methods courses is undoubtedly a good thing. But the one thing I always wonder, teaching methods courses in a psychology department, is how well our quantitative courses are actually serving our own students whose primary focus is in a niche area like quantitative methods. And so with an influx of empirical researchers into advanced quantitative classes, the content of those classes changes a little to accommodate the broader interests and backgrounds of those students. So when you're teaching a course for a more diverse audience, you got to consider the balance between practical aspects or information about specific software and the more abstract technical details that method students really benefit from to understand what's going on under the hood statistically. The shifting composition of quant classes and the concessions we make to balance the course content sometimes feels like we're turning our backs a little on our own students. Our students kind of get left out, and I think their development might end up being delayed a little bit as a result. I think all of this combined perpetuates treating quant like a service to the other areas in behavioral science, rather than as an independent area with its own challenges and approaches to inquiry that are not always of interest to non-quant students.
So maybe this is a nice wrapping up point. Maybe what we should do up to this point is just agree to ignore Dan McNeish. It's okay, Ben. It's okay.
Oh my God. That such people live.
It's okay. We are blessed.
We are blessed. We are blessed.
Yes.
So, let's talk about Knuckles. Dan McNeish, a.k.a. Knuckles, and there is a story behind where Knuckles came from, and it's Knuckles without the K, so it's important to realize it's just Knuckles with the N.
Is there an apostrophe in place of the K, or just no apostrophe at all?
Dude, don't overthink it. Don't strunk and white it, all right? It's just Knuckles. How hard can that be?
Okay.
Professor Quant Psych, Arizona State University, he went through your program. Was he your student?
He was everybody's student, Patrick. He was just too much for any one faculty member. So we all worked with Dan, and we also had good enough sense to just get the hell out of his way.
I was incredibly fortunate. He came through Carolina for a bit before heading on to ASU. And at our research meetings, it turns out we already had a Dan. And so at our first research meeting, we simply renamed McNeish Knuckles to separate him from Bauer.
How was this chosen?
It's kind of like an onomatopoeia. The name sounds like what it is. Mm-hmm. So crash or phlegm. And you just look at McNeish and it's just Knuckles.
Just baked in there.
It's just baked in. So the man is not wrong in his comments. And just a second. We should do his viewpoint justice that it deserves in an episode entirely on its own.
I completely agree, Patrick. I think that would be a wonderful idea.
Good.
So first, let's clarify the topic. When he was talking, he was focusing specifically on the training that students get as quantitative methodological students. And I would like to expand that a little bit. I don't think we need to focus on broad quant training in general, because we already addressed that. I think what we need to do is think about how we can provide a sufficient education so that people can contribute to the quantitative methodological literature, whether or not they're quantitative methods students. You and I have spoken about so many of the key players throughout the history of our field who really came to this from other places. Everybody who is sitting in the classes that I teach, every one of them has the potential to make some version of a quantitative contribution.
You can be a quant doctoral student, but a whole lot of people are in other kinds of substantive areas that have every ability, every passion, every desire to make unique and novel contributions to the field of quantitative methodology through the clinical sciences, developmental sciences, educational sciences. All of this applies, as we talk in the upcoming minutes, about even if you're a developmental psychologist, how do you obtain a deeper drill down training, knowledge, understanding in the mechanisms that underlie these models, so that when you understand the matrix, right, that final scene in the matrix where he sees all the numbers coming down.
Yeah.
He is the one.
At what point do you see that kind of understanding with the SEM or the MLM or whatever it is you might be interested in?
But this isn't really about you, Patrick. It's not really about me. It's about the key insights of Dr. McNeish. Oh,
that's right. I'm sorry. Okay. Every okay. 5 minutes, is that what's dictated?
Could you look at section 3, subsection D?
Okay.
Point
III.
III. Yeah.
Okay, we're good.
Think about an arc that goes on for people's training. Anybody, whether you're formally in a quantitative methods program or you're someone who wishes to become very, very skilled in quantitative methods to be able to make contributions that bridge substantive areas and quant. It starts for me with just knowledge acquisition, right? Tool gathering, learning about some of these methods. This is your first exposure to what looks like. You walked into Home Depot and it's just aisle after aisle after aisle of stuff that you just feel like, oh my gosh, I have to gather all this stuff. I have to learn all of this stuff. It's incredibly overwhelming. Class after class that keeps piling on new tools.
But totally cool. You walk down Home Depot and you're like, I didn't even know they made that.
Oh my God, I need that.
What does it do? I don't know.
Doesn't matter.
But I want it.
In the initial phase, really it's about acquiring all of these tools, becoming familiar with them. But from the start, this is a challenge. What Dan had laid out is absolutely true, because you have this class that is serving people with primarily applied goals. And there are people in there, whether they're quantitative methodological students or not, who really need a deeper dive. This is a challenge that we also discussed a little bit with Becca over the summer during QuantiCamp. And so my first question is, how do we provide that deeper dive for those people who are otherwise getting what, to be completely honest, is a somewhat surface treatment of a lot of these tools?
I hear sometimes a quantitative methods student, and again, we'll just have a disclaimer at the front among all the many disclaimers we have in this particular episode, that when we say a quantitative student, it doesn't mean what area you're in. It's what are your interests and what are your aspirations for contributing to the sciences. So a quantitative student who expresses some frustration that they're learning structural equation modeling with everybody else, right? Mm-hmm. They're a quantitative student, and here they're sitting next to developmental students and clinical students and social students. And it drives me a little crazy on several levels. One is just what you're talking about, is this need to establish a foundational understanding of what is structural equation modeling, how is it applied, how do you use it, that tool aspect of it. It's also a little crazy because I actually am kind of proud of my SEM class, and I don't think I'm watering it down in a way that is a point-and-click-like class. We do covariance algebra, we derive model implied covariance matrices, we talk about building up likelihoods. And so I think there's maybe a misunderstanding that somehow there's a Sesame Street version of SEM and then there's a real version of SEM.
The number of the day is 4.
I don't have a large skill set, but one of them that is pretty well developed is my ability to tie airplanes into any discussion that we have. And how I sometimes think about it is, it's a similar analogy to the tools, but let's say that you want to develop a better airplane, all right, whatever that might be. Well, the logical place to start is to learn how to fly the damn thing first. And not only learn how to fly it, but learn how to fly it really well.
What kind of plane is it?
Oh, it's a big, pretty white plane with red stripes, curtains in the window and wheels, and it looks like a big Tylenol.
So to understand every aspect of it, the control surfaces, using it in different conditions, become a real expert in piloting that aircraft, then you're ready to step back and start walking around and saying, well, why was this designed in this way? Well, okay, I understand why this is here, but what are the limitations? What are the stress tolerances of that? Starting to take it apart and being able to put it back together, and then be able to look at it and say, I got an idea. If I take this here, move this here, change this here, maybe that will give an improved version. That all starts with become an expert pilot before you start thinking about how can I take this apart and put it back together in a way that gives me something new and unique that no aeronautical engineer has thought about before.
Do you think that the people who are taking your class are becoming expert pilots with the curriculum that you have?
I think it's a first step. What drives me nuts is when a student says, I already took an SEM class, so I don't need to take that again. Mm-hmm. Often, I think, take a second time, take a third time. Ken Bolin, we're blessed to have Bolin in our area, and Bolin was teaching SEM, and a student I was talking to and said, well, I already had it from you, so I don't need to take it. I've met that requirement. And I was like, dude, you can take SEM from Ken Bolin. He'll correct all the errors that I taught you in my class. So no, absolutely not. does one lecture on assessing model fit let you fly 777s for United Airlines, but it's a hell of a start.
I feel a lot of tension, even in the introductory courses, because intro stat, there's a lot of depth to it, right? There's a lot of calculus associated with it, and you can talk about that, but at least in my case, that will just not fly. Won't fly with the audience that I have. On the other hand, there are some people who really want to do that. I had this student in my class who was in math ed, so she had a lot of very good math background, and she asked me something about where the intercept and slope come from in a standard regression. And I made some slightly hand-wavy kinds of things in terms of explanation and minimizing a particular function. And the next day came and showed me all the derivations she had done to try to uncover that. I was really, really inspired by that. And what I did after that was I started to create all of these supplemental materials, took students farther down the iceberg to try to understand where these things came from. And the version of the class that I taught at the introductory level wasn't a puppet show, right? It wasn't Sesame Street, but it had to balance the goals that people needed as researchers with having some understanding. For me, the answer was trying to keep it at an algebra level. I would have loved to have gone farther down the iceberg. But what I did is I created these blue sheets at the time that tried to supplement that. At this point in time, the internet is the big blue sheet. If a student is sufficiently motivated, they can go in there and start to figure out all of the underpinnings. But I remember learning that the blue sheets weren't for everybody because I would go over a particular topic. I might go over sums of squares and error terms and decomposition of between and within, something like that. And then I would say, for those people who would like a little bit more, let me hand out this blue sheet to show you where all of this comes from. And one of the students in the class goes, "Blue sheet. Blue sheet." But that was one of the ways that I tried to make sure that people were filling in the gaps. But now I try to turn them on to some resources out there that complement stuff. But I don't know that I'm doing the right thing.
Well, I think that's one of many potential things that we can do. I'm teaching longitudinal SEM right now, and I had one reading for the whole class. And then I had one reading if you were more application interested, and another if you were more quantitatively interested. So there was one that was a bit, you know, deeper drill, and one that was more of applied focus. Still very rigorous, but more applied focus. I think there are little things we can do like that. Here's a couple of worries I have about that as a general strategy. One is there are aspects of taking apart the airplane and putting it back together that you need some guidance by an expert in the field. There's a need for a formal class that is a deeper drill down, not just an added paper. Read this paper if you're a little bit more interested. There needs to be a Mr. Miyagi.
"I promise teach karate. You promise learn. I say you do. No question."
The other thing is, I had a colleague, and it was very sweet that he would do this, but he would teach the service course, and then the quant students would stay after for an extra hour, and he would drill down. Okay, totally, totally cool. Except he didn't get credit for that, and the students didn't get credit for that.
Yeah.
So you don't want to build a system where it's unequal, especially from the student's end. Who cares about faculty? Right. And I mean that kind of, it's like, just shut up and do your job. You don't want to make for quant students it to be a 4-hour credit class when you're only getting 3 hours of credit. This is not fair. So one thing we've done at Carolina is reinstituted a thing that fell off the books and we put it back on, is a 1-hour seminar that is for quant students only. It augments then what the service course is with a bit more drill down. Then there's not some inequity that, well, if you want to really know more about the quant methods, you've got to spend more time and work harder, and you're going to not get anything to show for that.
Does that occur at the end of some sequence? Or is it, does it somehow parallel?
It can be anything. And that's what I really like about it, is what we'll sometimes do is I'll teach a 3-hour service sequence for, say, structural equation modeling. And then there'll be an advanced 1-hour where we say, all right, let's do a drill down. In class this week, we talked about this. Now let's look at what are the matrices doing, that kind of thing. I'm doing a 1-hour now that is not hooked to a class, but it's just a for quant students only, And mm-hmm. it's really fun. We're doing quantitative research methods. So how do research methods arise uniquely in the quantitative mm-hmm. sciences?
Yeah, how do we know things?
It's yes. quantitative methodology is an epistemological system. How do you know about the world through a quantitative lens? What Knuckles referred to as, well, like a class in simulation, is we're going to spend a lot of time talking about simulation as a way of knowing from a design perspective. Not mm-hmm. here's how you generate data in R. Who cares? Go figure that out. But it's how do you design an experiment to gather empirical data to test research hypotheses. So it's kind of dealer's choice. You can do anything you want with it.
I want to take a little bit of issue with something that you said. You said something about it not being fair for the students to have that extra hour that they're not getting credit for. And I don't know that I feel the same way about that. In my view, it's an opportunity for students to be able to get extra insights into how these things work. And I can only sort of look at it through the lens of what I was like as a student. But if someone said, hey, we have an extra hour and we are encouraging, all right, let's say that. We are encouraging our own students to join and unpack, and there can even be fun ways to do it. Each week a student takes a method and gets at the underpinnings and shares it. There are ways to do this that fulfill this need, and I don't really see it as a fairness issue, honestly. Part of that is because we do something like this. We have a whole bunch of topics. Some of them are professional topics, but we have other more technical topics that what we do is we have what we call lunch and learn. Once or twice a month throughout the year, we will have a particular topic that is offered by a faculty member, and it can be drilled down into a variety of different things. And we expect that our doctoral students are going to attend this. But I'll tell you, I think that for someone who wants to learn more, that it's not unfair. In fact, it's a gift. But maybe I'm too harsh and old school.
You're not. I completely agree with you. It's consistent with other ideas I have about trying to balance learning to fly the plane and then learning to take the plane apart and put it back together. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those relate to things that you would do outside of a 3-credit hour class. I think having an additional hour in that way really is a wonderful opportunity. I think from my perspective, maybe that just needs to be recast. We've talked on prior episodes about not everything you learn in grad school comes in a classroom, in a course mm-hmm. pack with an asynchronous video. And this is a really nice way of doing that, is to say, all right, everybody take a break, come back, and we're going to talk for an hour just on our own, for our own edification, mm-hmm. about, in class, I said, Bolin on page 89 works through the covariance algebra. Let's go ahead and cue that up and go through this line by line. Mm-hmm. I agree with your disagreement with my agreement.
That's totally clear. So with your permission, I would like to transition us into phase two. And phase two for me is the real world nuts and bolts, roll up your sleeves application of the things that you've learned. And of course, you learn about applications as you're learning about regression and all of these other techniques. But I'll tell you, when you encounter these things in the wild, it never really looks like the examples that you have in class. And in fact, in class, it's often very difficult to strike that balance between reality and an example that's so sterile that it doesn't come close to what's going on. But I want people to experience mess. And I especially want the students who are in my own program to have an opportunity to apply the things that they're learning, because it only solidifies what they've been exposed to.
Belaboring my analogy is that's getting flight experience.
Logging hours, right?
We had a number of years ago, extraordinary student in our program, and he was very technically proficient. One of those like 1 in 1,000 kind of students you get every now and then. And he worked as an RA on a project I was involved with. It was real data. It was early on integrative data analysis. We had a research space on the other side of campus, and we were walking back, and he was doing data analysis for us. And it was very complicated data analysis. We were doing early on integrative data analysis with moderated nonlinear factor analysis. At some point, I almost apologized to him mm-hmm. for squandering his skills. Mm-hmm. I was like, look, I really appreciate you contributing in this way. And he was so thoughtful, and he paused and he said, it is helping me understand what the important quantitative questions are. That stuck with me for a lot of years. Mm-hmm. In his delving into messy, complex data with a substantive focus, mm-hmm. it was highlighting to him what the limits limitations of our current methods are and served as a crucible for developing novel quantitative questions, and is consistent with what you're saying. When you throw yourself into the messiness of real data, mm-hmm. you start to see where things work well and where things maybe don't work so well.
And some of the places that come to mind really quickly that we try to get our students involved, certainly we have a lot of applied grant opportunities where, as methodologists, we might be written in a supporting role to a particular grant, but we have the opportunity to involve our students in some of those analyses. I think that is incredibly important for them to experience. And you're absolutely right, that you start to get a sense of where the holes are in our understanding of things, and then ultimately informing what will be stage three. But we're not there yet. Also, being in the DC area, we have affiliations with a number of agencies around, well, not just the DC area, but even up and down the East Coast, where our students really get to immerse themselves in the mess that is the actual data analysis. We also have a course that's in consulting, where whoever is teaching that coordinates with a real faculty member or multiple faculty members somewhere on campus. And those problems that they bring are used with a group of students to start from the beginning and working through all of the problems, thinking about what needs to be done, so that at the end, they've sort of gone through everything but the planning, right? They didn't go through the design of it, but all the mess on the back end. And I have to say, the students come out the other side of that so much wiser.
It was a number of years ago, I don't remember the details, I was at a conference and there were some grad students presenting, and one of the quantitative students said something along the lines of, "I don't do real data." And I was like, first, I have no idea what that even means. But second, echoing of what a lost opportunity that is. Mm-hmm. I understand that simulation is often the coin of the realm in our area, and derivations and proofs and things like that to varying degrees. I don't know if I've ever published a derivation and proof myself. Mm-hmm. For a long time, I thought lemmas were what followed each other and jumped off the cliff and drowned. If I want to be really snotty, is I'll finish a argument and say QED.
That's
I have
right.
no idea what it means, but evidently it stops the argument.
It is the mathematical mic drop.
All right, so I'll look that up sometime. Maybe we could make some quantitude gag out of that QED.
Oh.
All right, I'll have to think about
quantitude that. Quantitude erectile dysfunction.
At the Boston Medical Group, I met with a specialist who understood what I was going through.
The Boston Medical Group. Proven results or your consultation is free.
Okay, that's just a start.
Yeah,
I'm just spitballing here.
Okay. Yes, I completely agree. And textbook examples are just this side of useless because they are simulated, mm-hmm. they're simplified, they're bulletproof, and it's not until you get in the fog of war, right? I read all these World War II books, and Eisenhower has that line. I don't remember the exact phrase, but the military plans hold until the enemy is engaged. And I think that same concept yeah. applies here, is what you learn in class is sometimes of dubious utility when mm-hmm. you can't invert your covariance matrix to even start your analyses.
So I have a question for you, and it might have had a better home in the first phase when we were talking about tool gathering, but I think it spills over into learning to apply things properly. What do you think is an absolutely essential set of analytical techniques that someone should be exposed to as part of a graduate program?
Mm. It's a great question, and one that I think I will invoke how we teach about moderators, which is it depends, mm-hmm. right? Because it depends what you want to achieve. It depends on how you want to make contributions. It depends on what your skill set is that you brought with you and how you want to augment that. For example, myself, I don't do what I would call mathematical, statistical kind of work. Mm-hmm. I've never published in Psychometrica, and I probably never will, unless it's something that I do with you and I can be like fourth author on.
Wait, but you were my reviewer in Psychometrica.
So there's an irony there.
Okay. Great.
Okay, so there's another episode that we can be court-ordered to discuss at some point, is I don't have the skills or aspiration to publish in Psychometrica, but I do a fair amount of reviewing for Psychometrica.
Yeah. if not an episode when we see Dr. Michelle,
we'll
maybe
talk
that
to
should
Dr. Michelle about that.
That should come up.
Yes, that's a good point. I hear you. I see you.
Oh.
And you continue to annoy me in a way that's hard to put words to.
No, you blew it.
Oh, damn it.
You blew it. I know, but the first part was solid.
So given the it depends, even if you don't go down the derivation route, is having a really good handle on how to manipulate and live among matrices, I think, is hugely important. 100 years ago when I was at UCLA and I was going to teach multivariate, and Bengt Mutain was my advisor, and he used a term I liked, is he said, you really want to be able to massage the matrices. And I like that, is that, you know, kind of get them to do what you want them to do. So I think a really good foundation in just matrix linear algebra, that would be a big one. One is whatever flavor it is, have a really strong foundation in programming, computational programming.
Yeah.
That can be SAS. I don't mean it has to be something that you're compiling or posting to CRAN or whatever it is you do, because I think of computer programming as a way of thinking. It's a way of thinking about the world. It's a way of processing information. And whether you're using ProcIML in SAS or if you're in R or Python or whatever it is, but having a framework for thinking about the world from a programming perspective, I think is really important.
I agree with both of those. It sort of sets up the idea of the student becoming an independent learner too, because those are some of the tools that allow them to be able to make their way into the depths of things that don't make it into the curriculum, right? It's like, oh, our students graduated and they didn't have a course in cognitive diagnostic models. What are we going to do? But they have the skills to be able to acquire that kind of knowledge. And so you have to find that balance between telling them everything and giving them the tools to be able to learn these things on their own. And that was a point I think that was made really nicely in the teaching episode that we had previously. We need students to get in the mindset that knowledge is out there for them to acquire. This isn't a salad bar where they grab what they have and that's it, right? We're supposed to teach them how to acquire these things on their own.
I came up through clinical training. My PhD's in clinical psychology. There's some real parallels that I think quantitative could benefit from mimicking. There is core coursework in the first 2 years, typically in a clinical program, about diagnostics and assessment and theories of psychopathology, and it lays down this foundation. But then what you do are clinical prac, right? Practicum. You go into the community, you work 20 hours a week doing whatever, and then you become increasingly more independent. And then you go on internship for an entire year where you're doing more than full-time clinical work. None of that comes through a lecture or a set of course notes. You learn that foundation, and then you are under a structured and supervised setting. You roll back your sleeves and you get to work. I think we do that in quantitative methodology, but I think maybe we could do it better. Having a practicum-like experience where we move quantitative method students from single A ball to double A to triple A, you move them in structured and supervised ways to becoming independent researchers.
Time to go down on the farm, check out on the Rays triple A affiliate. That's the Durham Bulls.
I like that way of thinking about it, that analogy. But you know what would be kind of fun? What's that service called where professors go on sabbatical and they live in other professors' homes? Do you know what that, do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't.
Okay.
Do you like swipe right or swipe left on sabbatical?
Yes. Their family stays there. Right? How cool would it be if in one of the latter years in your program, you went and spent 1 year in another university's program? Wouldn't that be cool to have sort of an exchange program?
Especially if I could pick the students who go.
I noticed that you didn't say pick the students who come to you.
Yes. You and you, off to Maryland.
Oh, it would be an interesting experience. One of the things that struck me most as an administrator is a conversation that I had with a supervisor, someone who oversees the interns who come in for a summer internship program. And what that person said that really made me feel good about what we were doing was that when she would put a problem out on the table for the interns, she said, what she noticed is that in a lot of programs, they go immediately to one particular tool. They say, oh, let's do this as an IRT thing. But the people that she thought were the ones who were the best trained were those who treated their knowledge as something to sample from. If we take this aspect of a multi-level model, we take this aspect of a latent variable model, we take this aspect of something longitudinal, then we can put them together and create something that we need. And what she said is that she thought that the strongest interns that she had were ones who could really see the forest a lot better than just stand around next to a tree the whole time that they were there. And I have to say, that really inspired me to try to make sure that our curriculum, as much as possible, created people who have a sense of forest. I think it is so important that the students have perspective, and that really takes a while to develop.
Yeah, I think those are wonderful programs that you have. We don't have those here to that extent, but we do have a lot of RA positions that are in other areas of the program.
Yeah.
That's one of the wonderful symbiotic relationship I feel like we have in our department. Somebody from social psych will call me or send an email and say, hey, I could really use a student who can help with dyadic data, longitudinal analysis. I have an RA for 12 months. Do you have somebody available?
Mm-hmm.
Those are just invaluable. Let me jump back one topic because we're kind of bouncing around a little bit. So it's a common episode as all others are. But you were talking about the core stuff, right? And so we talked about maybe matrix stuff, maybe some kind of computational. The third one I would add is what Knuckles explicitly alluded to and what you guys at Maryland I know do really well, which is teach a class in some form or another in computer simulation.
Mm-hmm.
It is not how do you generate data for a P by P correlation matrix of this structure. That is go figure it out. And not a like, I walk to school uphill both ways in the snow, go figure it out. It's like, well, it depends. What platform are you in? What are you trying to do right there? That's a mechanical aspect. Are you going to do that in R? Are you going to do that in Python? Are you going to do it in whatever? It's not that. What it is a formal introduction to computer simulation as a mode of gathering empirical data. So I have another diatribe I can go on about how computer simulation methodology for quantitative is our way of gathering empirical data to evaluate theoretically derived research hypotheses that are important to us and to our field. And computer simulation is precisely the same thing as a developmental psychologist going into a school system and observing children at play. We just do that through the simulation. And I feel like so often we cut over the design aspect and go right to how do I generate a non-normal deviate under MCAR missingness? And it's like, wait, that's like step 18.
Right.
We got to talk step 1 through 17 about why are we doing this? What are our options? How do we design this? How are we identifying levels of our factors that optimally test our theories and our hypotheses? But as Knuckles says, that's a hard one because do you have a standalone class? What if you have a small cohort, right? If you have you can't teach a class to 3 grad students. No program is going to let you do that. That's a hard one to address. Now, you guys, I've emailed with Jeff Herring, who you guys teach a class in this, don't you?
Yeah, we do. Many years ago, probably about 15 or 20 years ago, we didn't have a class in that. And the vibe of the department that I joined was sort of like only the worthy shall pass. And you will figure out how to do a simulation. And if you can't, maybe you don't belong here in the first place.
None shall pass. I have no quarrel with you, good Sir Knight.
That's not really how I viewed things. I think there's a certain amount of that you show initiative and you learn things on your own. But I also think if you're expecting people to know how to do things, that it helps to structure their experiences so that they actually know how to do those things. And so I put together a course that actually is a combination of things, and it overlaps with something that you said previously. It's called Mathematical and Simulation Foundations. It circles back to some of the derivations, but also those foundations greatly inform the way that we think about knowing things, because ways of knowing things, it's not just simulation, ways of knowing things include derivations and a lot of these kinds of foundational things. So our students solidify their foundations and then they do simulation. And doing simulation exactly as you say, it's not learning about, I mean, although you cover how to generate certain things in different platforms, it's more about the way of thinking. And we had a whole episode on simulation last season, Carlo, Monte Carlo, whatever episode that was. But just to skim from that episode, designing simulation studies is something that requires its own way of thinking, right? And it has tremendous parallels to the research that other people do. There's good design, there's bad design, there are issues of validity, internal validity, external validity, all of those kinds of things. And I think it's really important not to convey simulation as a series of code snippets that you just keep pasting together, but rather, if this is a question that I want to know, what would be a good way to design a study to get at that? And how do I rationalize the choices that I've made and so forth? So yeah, a number of years ago, we created that course, and it's something that Jeff Herring took over quite a while ago, and he has just done great things with it. And the beautiful thing is that students who come out of it really have some of the tools to be able to move ultimately to that third phase, which is creating their own knowledge.
You keep counting them phases, but then you call them stages, mm-hmm. and but you haven't told me what the phases or stages are, so I don't know where you're going with this. So I don't know if I'm telegraphing like phase five of where you're going. My guess is you just pull these out of your butt as you go. So it's hard for me to step on your toes when even you don't know where you're going. But one thought I have is, in any given program, there are a limited number of faculty who are available to teach these kinds of things. And there are a limited number of students to make a class at this level. Mm-hmm. We have a fairly big quantitative program for a doctoral program, and we have 14 graduate students. So if you think about an incoming class on average is two or three students, and you offer these classes even every other year, Carolina now has a minimum as you need six students to even offer a class. I mean, the numbers are small and it's hard to do these things. But now that we're all used to Zoom and we're all used to these platforms, I see some exciting opportunities for doing some shared learning. And so if Jeff is going to teach that class, that maybe somehow we coordinate with us, but then there's a quid pro quo. We could set up something at Carolina that your students would be able to take. I think there's a lot of opportunities. So it's kind of like integrating across a sparse distribution, which is you gather all the quant geeks together in one place who really want to learn about simulation methodology and do a shared Zoom instruction. And as you point out, that opportunity equity thing we were talking about before, how do you get credit for it on your transcript? Well, you freaking don't, right? This is just part of the gig in learning how to do this. And I got to tell you, I don't know about you, but no one has ever asked for my transcript from grad school. Right? I mean, we're beyond that. Yeah, no. They're going to find out I actually have a GED. At this level, that doesn't matter anymore. You have to move out of the mindset that, well, will I get credit for this on my transcript? And the answer is, who cares? You're going to learn how to do simulation from Jeff Herring. You're going to learn how to do simulation from the editor of MBR. This is an opportunity that you wouldn't have otherwise. So I think there's some clever and creative ways we can think about how to address these problems in phase 5.6 once we get there.
No. It's phase three that we're moving into. It is the final phase. So the third phase, which I actually have been quite clear about telegraphing the whole time, so I can't help it if you're not entirely paying attention, is knowledge creation, knowledge generation. And that to me is where people who are studying quantitative methods ultimately need to go. And some of that comes from the skills that you acquire in designing methodological studies that involve simulation. Some of them involve some of the analytical skills, possibly, that you have acquired. A lot of them come from our exposure to a lot of the different hands-on data analytical things where we see the holes that are there that we don't otherwise get in a typical class. So the last step for me to make sure that people leave our programs with is the ability to generate knowledge. And for me, that does not start with the dissertation. That is something that you are working your way up to. For me, the dissertation is where the training wheels are off, and you know, maybe you're doing it on your own, but you should have been involved in knowledge generation well before you get to the dissertation phase.
You know, Greg, it takes a village to raise a graduate student because it's a gestalt of all of this, right? We have foundational service classes. We have specialized classes. We have one-hour seminars. We have working with your advisor one-on-one. I really like your lunch thing where you get together and as long as you don't call it journal club, just call it something else. I don't care. And another one that I think, again, as faculty, we can structure better and support better is peer-to-peer kind of learning, right? Sure. As you have office mates and you have people who have walked where you're walking now and to say, oh, I had to deal with this. And so trying to structure it in that way. And when you integrate over the entire topology, you get these kinds of deeper experiences that you want. But why, yes, speaking of airplanes, I can return to that analogy, is there's an old saying that PhDs design planes, masters builds them, bachelors fly them, and GEDs fix them. It's not apocryphal. That is very close to how the process works. Mm-hmm. But what's so important is you can work your way up and down that chain. Mm-hmm. You need to know how it works so that you could fix it if you needed to, that you at least understand that, that you could build that, that you can fly that. And then the capstone perspective, as you're saying, is you make a new kind of airplane that hasn't existed before, but only because you've come up through that whole chain of experiences and knowledge and understanding. We can return briefly to one of my grievances, but don't complain about being in a quote-unquote service class with applied users. Is if you feel that way, I'll be frank, I don't think you're understanding how you learn to be a quantitative methodologist. Yeah. You're not among the unwashed as you're learning this in some watered-down way. You are learning how to use these methods and these techniques in an advanced, careful, thoughtful, rigorous way. And from that foundation, you can start to take things apart and put it back together. And that's not a point of frustration. That is, this is my starting point, and I'm going to move forward from here.
As we have said, and others have said many times, that if you really want to understand something, try to teach it. It is so much fun when we have students who are seeing themselves on a track toward academia, and we have them teach an undergrad intro stat class after being mentored in it for a semester where they support me teaching it, and then they get a section of their own. How often my conversations with them where they admit that I thought I understood that before. I mean, it's only a t-test or it's only regression, but now I know why that's there. And I love that. And you know what? That aha, it can occur in any class at any level. And like you said, if you start to arrange opportunities for people to explain things to each other, holding them accountable for how things work, everybody learns from that. It's a wonderful thing.
I realize how much I sometimes channel for my mother of who I've become as a parent. She was one of nine on a dairy farm during the Depression, and her parenting style reflects that. We've talked about that on prior episodes. Uh-huh. One of my daughters was very young. I had given her, I don't remember, like an old camera or something. She loves to take things apart. And she spent a bunch of time at the kitchen table, and everything she had taken apart on the table and was all lined up. She was so excited. And she said, look what I did. And I looked and I said, that's amazing, sweetie. Now put it back together. There's an element of that, right? It's very easy to take something apart. Now put it back together. And that really shows that you're understanding how these systems work. And when you put it back together, then maybe you see, oh, I could make it a little bit better than it was.
Two other things that I will mention along the knowledge generation side, which is the third and final phase.
You already said we had a third and final phase.
This is it. No, I'm adding to that.
Oh, jeez.
If I can remember it. Hang on. Yeah.
Remember it. You're making it up.
It's true. Two things. One is we do a lot with independent studies here where as a student progresses in their training, they take fewer and fewer courses that are offered formally and do more credits that are independent study. And independent study has a lot of flexibility. And to be quite honest, with some students, they go into it thinking it's dependent study, and you have to you have to fix that pretty quickly. But with different students, you provide different degrees of guardrails for things that they're going to learn. But in the end, they're learning how to learn with those independent studies. And one of the ways that I really love structuring those is where it's got two parts. One is over the course of a semester, the student meets with me fairly often and teaches me materials. This is what I've learned this week, and now I'm going to give you a presentation on it. I love that because both of us learn a tremendous amount. But at the end of most of these independent studies, there will also be a methodological project where now that you have learned something about the inner workings of this and where this is situated within the literature, I want you to design the next study that needs to be done. Or a next study that needs to be done. And that has been such a fruitful thing because then students go on and they actually try to do a methodological investigation. I love that. So that's one thing that has been very, very successful. The other thing that we have done that I'm just really so happy about is we have Research Day every year. And ours is coming up at the end of March where every doctoral student has to present on methodological research that they have been doing in the past year. I mean, it is a full-on conference-style presentation. There are moderators, there are questions from the audience, and so forth. And it creates a culture where people understand that they have to be creating knowledge. We don't throw them to the wolves. They're projects that they have been guided in to varying degrees. But ultimately, by the time a person is presenting one of these things for the third time or the fourth time, you see such growth in their command of subject matter, their skills at communicating, this kind of thing. That for me is a beautiful capstone kind of event to highlight the development that people have had in the generation of knowledge.
Maybe as we're starting to head toward the exit, is I can share a asymmetry I sometimes see that works in the opposite way of what we've been talking about. So the whole discussion has been, how does a quant methods-oriented student get deeper training in quantitative methodology by starting in these broader service classes? There's a parallel issue that we often deal with, which is we offer these big service classes in advanced methodology to all graduate students in the department, and we embrace that, right? I mean, that's a thing that we love and are committed to in dissemination and pedagogy. I mean, I love having that problem that there are 35 graduate students who want to take SEM. But there's an interesting asymmetry in that I want my quantitative students to have legitimate training in some substantive area of psychology. Because as I tell my students, when you get your PhD, it doesn't say quantitative psychology on it. All it says is psychology. That's all it says. Cognitive, social, clinical, developmental, quantitative. You are a psychologist, and we are contributing to the psychological sciences through the lens of quantitative methodology, which means that we are as much a psychologist as anyone else in the building. I would like to have students receive legitimate guided training in some substantive area within the psychological sciences. It is not uncommon for one of my graduate students to approach a faculty in another area and say, could I enroll in your seminar on whatever? And to be told, oh, this is actually for advanced students in our area, and I just don't think that this would be good for you. you because you don't have the background and the experiences to be part of the discussion. I get a little frustrated by that because, one, I don't like asymmetry. So in any given year, the quant program might fill 100 graduate seats, 150 graduate seats, and I can't get my grad students to have permission to enroll in another area's seminar because it's too advanced. And I would encourage, while we're talking about this, to think about that other side of the coin, is if a quantitative student approaches you to be part of some seminar you're teaching, is to remember, not only is there just a straight up quid pro quo, but that this is how the training works and that cross-pollination and to know what the important questions are. Just a semi-arbitrary comment.
And for me, even just sitting in as an auditor in some other kind of capacity gives you a sense of the kinds of things that that discipline might be wrestling with and opportunities for methodological marriage with some of those problems. So I like that.
So I hope that we have been able to do justice to the insightful and thoughtful contributions made by Dr. Daniel McNeish from Arizona State University. Do you believe that we have met our criteria?
I think that we have met criterion one, but that I would greatly welcome Dr. McNeish to join us to talk about some of the knowledge generation that he himself has done in his impressive corpus of work.
That is a brilliant idea, and I think an episode in the very near future will have Dr. McNeish as a guest to help us understand his insightful insights.
I think we did it.
Okay, cool. That's good.
God.
Now that we're not reading off a script anymore, I got nothing.
Well, I hope people have found our ramblings, our court-ordered ramblings to be useful, especially as we proceeded through the three stage phases from knowledge acquisition to knowledge application to knowledge generation. Anything more?
I'm done. Thank you, everybody, for your time. We always appreciate it. Stay safe.
Take care.
Hey, couponers. Don't forget to tell your friends to check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever they usually go to get stuff to listen to when they're out on furlough. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at QuantitudePod, and visit our website, quantitudepod.org, where you can leave us a message and listen to past episodes. And finally, you can get Quantitude merch on redbubble.com, where all proceeds go to donorschoose.org to help support remote access in low-income schools. The mugs are great for hot cocoa. Just ask our friend Oliver Felt. You've been listening to Quantitude.
Back to Folk. Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
This is Dan McNeish. You've been listening to Quantitude, presumably because you are also under a harshly punitive court order. Today's episode was sponsored by the Boston Red Sox, because no matter what Patrick might say, nobody actually wants to see the pitcher try to bat. He's got about as much chance of getting a hit as Patrick does of winning a trophy for anything, really. And by lobster, which are way better than Greg's Maryland crabs. Our crustacean can kick his crustacean's ass any day of the week. And finally, by subjective Bayesians and New York Jets fans, who both excel at sticking to their prior beliefs, regardless of reality around them. This is most definitely not NPR.
It has been 86 years. Generations have come and gone. And for the first time since 1918, the Boston Red Sox are champions of baseball.